Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features the remarkable Beverly Ruiz Muller speaking about her latest book, Hunting the Seven. Never have seven people been so hunted by assassins, by journalists, lawyers, and activists in search of the truth, and TRC investigators wanting justice for the victims' families. In 1986, seven young men were shot and killed by police in Guguletu in Cape Town. The nation was told they were a terrorist MK cell, which was plotting an attack on a police unit. An inquest followed, then a dramatic trial in 1987 and another inquest in 1989. Finally, the fact that Eugene de Kock's Flakplaas unit plotted and drove the operation was revealed at the Truth and Reconciliation 10 years after the murders. But Flakplaas's real agenda remained shrouded in mystery. In Hunting the Seven, Beverly Ruiz Muller tells the story of the Guguletu Seven and the hunt for the truth of their deaths. She reveals that it was Flakplaas's only operation in the Western Cape and was an elaborate, deadly scheme designed to keep the money rolling into the Death Squad's slush fund. In this episode of PageCast, Beverly is in conversation with award-winning journalist Birgit Tromp, the African editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Birgit Tromp. I'm the Africa editor at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project and the co-author of Honey, A Life Too Short. I'm here with Beverly Ruiz Muller, the author of Hunting the Seven, the story of the killing, the murder of the Guguletu Seven, a former journalist and a longtime lecturer at UCT. Hi, Beverly. How are you?
I'm well, and I'm very pleased to be talking to you. And I like your Honey book very much, by the way.
I'm so glad to hear that. But here we are talking about your book, which is hitting the shelves now, a critical book, I will argue, in the South African lexicon. Something that I think it's a story that, well, you make lots of arguments for why the story should be told. So, Beverly, how did it come about, the idea to tell the story? And once you had decided to tell the story, how did you decide to actually try and eat this elephant? How did you decide on the approach?
Yeah, it was an elephant to eat because it was a very mysterious story. From the beginning, I was never quite sure that I would be able to figure out what really happened. I started very, very early with a connection to the story. After the killings of these seven young men in March 1986, which was, you know, all over the papers, it was a very strange story. The story was that, you know, seven terrorists or communists or Russians or, you know, there were all sorts of wild theories about what had happened, had tried to attack the police in Guguletu, and the very brave South African security forces had killed them all. And from the beginning, it was an extremely odd story because nothing like that had ever happened in the Cape before, despite a lot of upheaval in the townships in the 80s. And when the reporter Chris Bateman first arrived on the scene from the Cape Times, he took a look at this and he saw, you know, seven dead men lying at the intersection of Guguletu and also in the bushes, and not single policeman injured or scathed in any way. And they were laughing, and it was a, you know, it was a great joke. And he immediately realized that there was something very wrong with the story. And that's really where the story begins, with Chris Bateman saying, "This story stinks. There is something wrong with this story." And if it hadn't been for him, this story today would never have been told. I got involved because at a very early stage, I was an activist. I was involved at UCT, used to be called Extra Parliamentary Groupings. And I was also very friendly with a number of Member of Parliaments who helped at the time, most significantly Tiaan van der Merwe, who was a spokesman for Law and Order, a very young MP who helped right from the beginning, helped the journalists, Tony, Chris, helped the families, helped arrange the funerals. And I was with him when he did that. And so I was present and saw the grief of the families, the shock, the lack of understanding of what had really happened, and the exceptionally bad treatment that they had from the police. One of things that I want to say, that this is also a story about seven mothers whose sons were killed for no reason at all, and who were terribly badly treated by the authorities. They weren't even told, you know, that their sons were dead. They had to find it out when the television came on, and there they saw their dead sons on the television. So it's a very brutal story from that point of view.
Beverly, you know, when I read the story, I must say that, I mean, I knew of the story. I didn't know everyone's role, so I did find it fascinating delving into this contemporary history. I mean, I remember being at high school during the state of emergency. And so, yes, this was all very, that took me back to that kind of very fragile time for our country. Now, you focused on these two journalists, Chris Bateman and Tony Weaver. So you focus on these two journalists. And I mean, I thought, well, maybe this is a device that you're using, a device like people have done before, where, you know, they say that journalists always, they write the first draft of history. So it's always useful to have that journalist's account to start to tell that story. But of course, they play that crucial role, well, various roles, I suppose, because initially, Bateman makes the first incision because he's a good journalist. He asks the questions. He doesn't just take the account that's offered by the police of, you know, we killed these terrorists before they could act or commit the act of sabotage. And then, of course, Tony Weaver also plays that critical role. Do you want to talk a little bit about it? You know, especially how, I mean, the most critical thing that there's the initial incision, as you pointed to with Bateman. But then Weaver, you know, the police deciding that they want to prove a point with Weaver. But that opens up a Pandora's box for the police, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that was a very stupid decision by the police to charge Tony Weaver and prosecute him in court the following year. Tony was a very, very experienced journalist. He was still young. He was, I think, at that stage, only probably 30, just 31. But he'd had a very long stint in Namibia covering Kufut and the Namibian War. So he was a veteran of police action. And, you know, he said to me when I was talking, I know Tony, and we are talking to him about this book, that he saw the Kufut role and the role that security forces played in Namibia and the incredible destruction that they caused there. And he said, one day these men are going to come back and they're going to be in our townships. And that was what he saw. That was what Chris Bateman saw, that these Caspers, machines that had never been seen in the townships before, the militarization of the townships happened after the Kufut had ended and the men who had run it came back into South Africa, and Vlakplaas was then set up. So, you know, these were two journalists who knew they were sticking their necks out, and the consequences were very serious. Both of them were charged for the stories that they ran that were contrary to the police stories. And the reason for that was that there was a police act during the states of emergency at that time. And so you had to get permission. This sounds so bizarre to me. You had to get permission from the police to publish a story about the police. And the point was that the police were never going to give you permission to publish the story. So every time they published anything that challenge the police story, they had to do it very, very carefully indeed. And I really want to also at this stage pay tribute to Tony Hurd, the editor of the Cape Times at that stage, who died only, you know, a few weeks ago, an incredibly brave editor who stood by his journalists and backed them when I don't think there was another editor in the country that would have done that. And both the journalists to this day, you know, give him credit for doing that. I knew Tony Hurd. I think he was a very brave man.
No, incredible journalist. Leaves an incredible legacy, does Tony Hurd. Stood up against the publisher who wasn't too keen to actually back the journalist. Even stood up against the BBC and made sure that they understood they'd be cut off if they did not back the journalist who they had used as a stringer.
Yeah.
Now, the personalities, there's Tony Hurd, of course, comes up. And of course, within the journalism world, he's quite a titan of yesteryear. But there's other people, of course, who's maybe even better known. Helen Suzman, for example. And what I appreciated with Helen Suzman's cameo, this is in a place called Mbekweni, outside of Paul, a place I know quite well. You make her quite human. Now, you know, and I love that, you know, I think it's so critical to show the feet of clay. So you have Helen Suzman, who's questioning, why am I being dragged out to this township outside of Paul to come and intervene on behalf of a funeral of people who had been dubbed terrorists by the government? So what the way you told it, I'm just thinking, like, you know, that there's this fallibility. Suzman is saying, but they've already been marked as terrorists. So what am I doing here? You know, so she's not really excited. And then Tian, of course, is convincing her about, you know, the cause that she's getting involved in. And I mean, this is a theme that happens. We know that this is an unjust, unfair system and government, but there's still this reliance on the government to a degree, which I found are rather interesting. I don't know if you want to just expand on that a little bit.
Absolutely. Look, I knew both Tian and Helen were quite well at that stage. We often used parliamentarians in situations where they could go in where activists and others couldn't, because they had, they had authority to do so. They explanation, some protection from parliament to do so. But Tian himself was very activist. Helen was much more, I knew Helen really well. I thought she was a wonderful person. And she was as tough as anything. I mean, you know, she was about 5 foot high, but boy, she could take down anyone. And that's one of my favorite stories in the book, because it's a very grim book. It is a story about death. It is a story about cold-blooded execution. That's what this was. And yet in the middle of this, you know, terrible situation where this family find out that they're son, 6 weeks later after the big funeral, their son has been killed and he's one of the Gugulethu Seven. And they've never even knew anything about that. And they try and bury him and the Mapal magistrate won't allow them to bury their son. What are they supposed to do? So Tian persuaded Helen to come out with the two of us to Mbekweni that morning to see if there was anything at all. And you're quite right. She was very, very reluctant. You know, she said, why are we going out there? You know, aren't they terrorists? I mean, what are we doing getting involved? And then Tian saying, but, you know, they have the right to bury their son like anybody else. And, you know, our job is to see that the law follows its course. You know, these sort of things follow. And then while we're in the hut, and we actually didn't know that the parents had been tortured at that stage, but I mean, the father was looking pretty terrible. John, his name is John Njobo. I get a tap on my shoulder and somebody says, the police are outside. So I go around the side of the shack. And in front of me, I see about 15 to 20 young men with guns in a firing position pointing at me and telling me to get out of the township and that we must all go, which was, I have to say, quite terrifying. And so I went back in and said to Helen, the police are here. And she came and she said, I will not have this. And she came outside and she tore such a strip off that officer that it was this most wonderful moment of, by the time she'd finished with him, she said the truth, which was, I do not need your permission to be in this township. I was on the standing committee in parliament that did away with the need to have a permit to be in the township. But by the time she finished with him, she had totally castrated those policemen. All their guns were drooping and towards the ground. And I mean, she just demolished them. And then she changed track. And she said to Tian, you have to do every single thing that you can to make sure that this funeral goes ahead. So, you know, but coming back to Cape Town in the car, we were trying to not to laugh in the car because of this about to. But it was partly because of Helen that, in fact, that funeral eventually went ahead.
Now, I love that scene. And I'm so glad. I mean, I didn't have to prod you further to just narrate that scene, because that was, I love that particular scene that, you know, what did you say? A 5 foot something. She drew herself up into a 5 foot something frame and, you know, confronted these policemen.
Yes.
I love that scene. Yeah. And of course the weapons pointed, which are then drooping and you know, these guys being emasculated. I absolutely love that. That was great. Just on the question of voice. So, you know, as you delve into the evidence, you don't introduce yourself until, I think, when you go to Mbekweni with Tian van der Merwe and Helen Suzman. You do not insert yourself into the book. So nothing is gratuitous here, which is always appreciated. But
Thank you.
Where you then do insert yourself, and now we're talking about evidence that you are leading and evidence that's being gathered, and you are presenting pieces of evidence through the story, but you're also narrating to the reader that this is where this fits in, and this is where the disconnect is between the evidence which I'm showing you and the police story. So you're constantly referring. So I feel like I am walking in a slow circle and examining the cadaver that's being displayed in front of us. Is that fair?
I mean, thank you for noticing that. It was a terribly difficult part of the book to write for two reasons. One, it was very traumatic. Especially I'd met the families, you know, I'd been to the funerals, I'd seen the grief that these deaths caused. But it was also, none of the evidence was assembled in one place. So for months and months, I had to pluck pieces of evidence from all over the place, post-mortem, the trials, the state, the lying affidavits of the police, and go through them very, very carefully and try and piece them together like an enormous jigsaw puzzle. And it took me months and months to do that, to finally to be able to say to the reader, look, this is what happened to them. This is how they were killed. And, you know, it's a pretty brutal story. And, you know, one of the things that I say again in the book is one can never really, I think, grasp how terrified those seven young men were when they simply got out of a van at the Guguleta crossroads one morning. And then these police started firing at them. And, you know, they had to run for their lives, and they were all seven killed. And mysteriously, none of the policemen were wounded in this apparently massive, you know, shootout. That was the hardest part of the book for me to write, that central section on how exactly each person, each one of the seven were killed, who killed them, how they were killed, how many bullets were in them, where they were killed. And also the one interesting thing that really vital thing I must mention is that all seven had shots in the head. And in a huge area, in a shootout like that, that is simply impossible.
So, you know, when you're writing a book like this, and when you're examining the forensic evidence that's been, you were revisiting some of this when you, of course, wrote the book more recently. Tell me about the kind of trauma that people experience at the time. I'm talking about these weren't activists. These were just young men living their lives. And then, of course, the parents. But the kind of trauma that was inflicted on these bodies and on the people around them, and even on yourself as a witness to some of this, albeit a secondary or third-placed witness.
Well, you know, I think it was part of a trauma that has never really been unpacked that was happening in the townships at the time. It was traumatic. You will know from reading the books what happened to me and my family and other after this. You know, we were, you know, put under surveillance, the phones tapped, the tires slashed, the threats made to my daughter in the middle of the night. That was actually by far the most traumatic thing. I was used to being, you know, slagged off by the police and under surveillance, but when they come after your children, I mean, that's really hard. But I also try and make a point that I could go home to Newlands, which was a nice, quiet, safe suburb. Okay, my phones were tapped and it was under surveillance, but it was a relatively safe area. The people from the townships couldn't. They lived all the time under the heavy thumb of, you know, the militarization of the townships. Day and night, tear gas, shooting, smoke. You know, that trauma, I'm not sure that the people who lived that have ever really fully recovered from it. And even though it's, you know, seems it's a long time ago, it's nearly 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago, I'm not sure that we as a country have ever fully addressed the traumatization of apartheid on ordinary men, women, families who were trying to just get by under a brutal system and who have never been compensated, never been allowed to live full lives despite the change of laws. I think that the many of the dysfunctional psyches of young people today is as a result of seeing what happened to their parents and knowing what had happened and then seeing very little, you know, change, no agency to change it, and no recognition of what they went through.
You know, that there's it must seem like a tsunami that you are facing, you know, because I mean, look, I look at that poor family in Mbekweni, and so many Black families encountered that during this time, where policemen would kick in your door at any given time. They would taunt you. They would tear things up. They would torture you. And you can say nothing. Your word counts for very little.
Actually, your word counted for nothing. And I do make that point. This was a very brutal assassination. It was murder. And yet, only three people applied for amnesty, because we discovered that actually it's a flag pass operation. And you know, in the end, we discovered the TRC, it's a flag pass operation. Only three people ever apply for amnesty for it, although there were dozens and dozens of security police involved, including killers. And they were all three given amnesty, even though they lied in the amnesty hearings. And not a single Cape Town policeman ever applied for amnesty for these killings. So the inquests that happened on the killings, where the police were found not guilty, still stands today.
Eventually, we end up at the TRC, but there's a line that you use here, because as you were explaining now, it turns out that the killing of these seven were not activists, just young men trying to make the best of their lives, who were caught up in this activity, which was orchestrated from the infamous Black Blast. It was once again a death squad. And the line that you use here, you say that it turns out that these seven young men were regarded as props in a snuff movie. And I mean, it's heart-wrenching to think of it in that way, because that's what they were. Because when you listen to, and I'll turn to you here, when we have the TRC hearings, we've got Balogun, is it? And he's questioned as to the motive for the killing of, the identification and the killing of these particular young men in Guguletu. And maybe you want to take it up here, like, you know, what was the reason? Why were they killed?
Yeah, that's the part of the book that, you know, that I really was going out on a limb on, because that's the part of the book that I think I asked myself the question, not who did it, because finally it came out that Flak Plas did it with some very good investigation from the DRC. They traced a car back to Flak Plas. And then after that, everybody knew that Flak Plas, Eugene de Kock, Rian Balakis Bellingen, which was his nickname, came down to the Cape and orchestrated this particular operation. What's also important is, Beauregard, is that this was the only Flak Plas operation that ever took place in the Cape. When I discovered that, I asked the question, why? Why was it that only once ever did Flak Plas come down to the Cape for this particular operation? What was in it for them? I mean, it's the long way down from Gauteng. They did operate all over the country, but they never came to the Cape. So what were they doing here in the first place? You will recall me saying in the book, unless you ask the question, you're never going to get an answer. And nobody had ever asked that question. So I started saying, what lay behind that? And going through Bellingen's evidence very, very slowly and carefully, both visual and text, and having attended some, I attended the TRC hearings, I attended some of the amnesty hearings, I noticed that there was a particular moment when his eyes flicked sideways. And I thought, that's odd. And when I went back and looked at it, he was talking about a video. And I thought the clue lies, that's where the clue lies. And that was when I started looking at the video that they had made. And it turns out that they had made an 18-minute video for the security cluster of the apartheid cabinet, which they showed them to say, if you give us a lot of money, this is what we can do. We can kill people. That was what this operation was all about.
It makes it so much more disgusting. And, you know, I think that is something that one of the things about South Africa that is very, very clear to me, at least, is that we have so many big events happening in succession that we forget so much of our very recent past. And we forget how corrupt this apartheid regime was still. So when anybody dares to suggest this apartheid regime was a better time for us, I mean, you cannot equate where we are now to an apartheid government. I think that is very shallow. Then you can only look at this example, for instance, where you argue and argue exceptionally well that, you know, these guys at Flak Plaas, they were also a very well-equipped money laundering operation. And they were laundering money and making sure that ministers were getting kickbacks, that senior members of the military and police regiment, that they were getting paid large amounts of money at the time, would be a pretty large amount of money in some cases, even today. So it was entirely corrupt, this apartheid regime. To think that they would set up something like this, take out these young men simply because that they simply served as you say, props in a snuff movie, makes it all the more disgusting. One of the things that you say or that you don't offer or go into, and I think that's probably another few chapters, is that there's no real explanation as to why the people responsible for the murder, because it is nothing less than murder of these seven young men, no one was prosecuted for that. And I mean, we have this in a number of situations. I mean, people who maybe are more prominent, people, the killers were never prosecuted. And of course, people die every day, and with them, the stories of what happened in our very recent past. So maybe you want to touch on that, Beverly?
Yes, I tried to explain in the book the difficulty that the TRC was facing was that, and I think people really underestimate the massive task that they were given at the beginning of 1996, 10 years after this killing, when they were asked to look at human rights violations in South Africa. You know, they were only able to look at ones that they could maybe reasonably bring, you know, to justice. And we tend to forget that they had to look at over 20,000 cases. And then from those, try and choose some that they thought that they might be able to get answers from. And one of the problems was that white security forces, the Flak Plaas, the generals, the people who had been involved in these human rights violations throughout, had counsel provided for them by the state. So they had very, very good legal counsel. And they just said, we didn't do it. They denied. And you know, it was very difficult to pin anything on them. So unless somebody actually confessed, it was almost impossible to prove that they had done something, given the fact that, as in this case, in this particular case, all the ballistic evidence was destroyed. And I go into detail in the book about that. The only reason that this case broke open was because the black constable, who was a Flak Plaas constable, Tepelo Mbelo, was heartsore about what he had done. And he came to the TRC and he confessed, because he thought his mother had died of illness when she found out what he had done. And if it hadn't been for him, this case, again, may never have actually been fully understood. He just couldn't bear the guilt any longer. But many of those constables, the members of the security forces and the other police murderer and robbery, others that were involved in these human rights violations, got away with it because they had very good legal counsel. They knew how the system worked. It was still very new into the new South Africa. And there was a massive amount of work to do. And I think that's why today there's a reopening of some of these TRC cases. And I've been in touch with, for example, Dumisa Ncebeza about this case. He knows about it. To say, I'd like it to be reopened, because those inquests that the police were not guilty still stand. And I think it's about time that we reinvestigated these cases, and that many people are dead now, but there are still not only some. It's not a question of, are they still alive to be prosecuted? It's a question of justice for the families. They deserve the world to know that they were victims of human rights violations, that their loved ones died because of it, and that their families suffered as a consequence of it. Plus, there's a matter of compensation that was never paid. Not one member of the seven families involved ever got compensation for what happened to their young boys. The young men, they called them boys, the young men. And I think that is an injustice that lasts to this day. And if I may just add to you, when I hear people say, you know, oh, the country's so bad, look what the ANC has done to the country, or et cetera, et cetera. I think, have you really forgotten how bad apartheid was? And that you fight one battle at a time. Nobody ever says we shouldn't have fought World War II because of what came after World War II. You defeat the enemy of the time, and then you move on and you try and actually make the world a better place after that. And yes, we've got challenges and we need to face them. But, you know, this dismissive of, oh, well, that was then, apartheid's over, just move on. I don't buy that. It's not over. And these people are still struggling, and we need to do something about that.
Absolutely, Beverly. I could not agree more. I must linger on this just in terms of what you're talking about. And this is, I think, very important for me because it's substantive. So one of the things that I enjoyed about the book was you left us on cliffhangers. Like, so if you thought that was interesting, guess what happens next? You know, I really enjoyed that. You're revealing different pieces of evidence and testimony and so forth. One of the things, like, and again, the reason I linger on this, and let me be completely transparent about this. When we look back at the atrocities of the apartheid era, we know that the apartheid government went and destroyed a lot of evidence. And it seems like all the evidence has been destroyed. So you feel a sense of like hopelessness, you know, and I think a lot of Black South Africans in particular, but South Africans, I think altogether, sometimes feel like, well, what can we do about that? But here we have a fascinating thing, you know, you have, and I mean, I know these people's work, you know, you've got, well, I know David Klatzau is renowned. He's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant person. And of course, you've got Dr. Van der Spay, and between the two of them, they looking at pictures and of the scene and the little bits of traces of evidence that's left behind, even though physical things like bullets and firearms, all of these have disappeared. But from there, they can make certain conclusions, which is presented, of course, in the case of in the Tony Weaver inquiry.
Those forensic specialists were absolutely brilliant. They were working with their hands tied behind their back because, as you say, all the forensic evidence was quite deliberately destroyed. And the reason was that, you know, they needed to do that because that would have proved that Google Letter 7 had actually not been armed and not been firing back. Van der Spay and Klatzau did an absolutely extraordinary job of piecing together what had really happened under incredibly difficult circumstances. And I think that they deserve very high praise for it. But this happened, you know, very often. You remember the Piet Retief episode I mentioned later in the book? Well, an almost identical thing happened in Piet Retief 2 years later. Almost a blow-by-blow account of what had happened in the Google Letter 7. And that has never been, you know, written about or unpicked properly and so on, because, you know, there was no one around, there weren't journalists around to actually say, hang on a moment, there's something really seriously wrong. The only reason we know it was a Flux Plus operation was because Eugene de Kock eventually admitted it was. He, at that stage, Eugene de Kock was singing like a canary because he had been fingered, you know, he had been left to take the blame for everything. So he thought, well, I'll just take everyone down with me. And in the end, there was an injustice in that. He went to jail for 212 years plus. And, you know, the people who he worked for, he said he was an assassin for the state. That means that he was paid by taxpayers' money to kill innocent people and, you know, other people. None of the politicians who employed him were ever punished. And I find that absolutely horrifying.
Absolutely. So that a final question I want to ask you of is the question of memory. You speak about the battle for memory over forgetting. And there's this beautiful line, and my writing is so poor, I should have just highlighted it in your book. You speak about Mandela and the setting up of the TRC and how he had insisted on not trying to ignore the country's murky past, because of course there are blemishes on the part of the liberation movements too. And he wanted to capture it before it was conveniently drowned in the lake of vanished deeds, to snatch at its grubby petticoats before they were whipped away. I love that line, by the way. That's beautiful analogies there.
Thank you.
And just the visualization, I really, really enjoyed that. You know, a lot of people will speak to the failures of the TRC. And I think, you know, once one comes to grips with the idea that it wasn't a be-all and end-all, people will realize that you know, you can't just lay it all at the feet of the TRC. But I want to tie this to the memorial that you speak of in Guguletu. I know exactly where you're speaking of, where this incident happened, where the seven were killed. You know, it's such a central place in Guguletu, as a point of entry. But you speak about the desecration of the memorials and how they'd been left to neglect. And I dare to say that that's unfortunately the case with the memorials for many of our heroes of yesteryear. And many people don't know why certain things are named in a certain way, why a town is called Harry Smith, for example. They simply don't know. And this is not just a question of young people not knowing. I think many people in South Africa don't know. They've forgotten, maybe. I'd just like you to close out by speaking about the necessity for us to remember what has happened in our all too recent past, actually.
Thank you for allowing me to end on this note. With my previous book, which was about the Boer story of the war bullet in the heart, and in this book, I deliberately chose to write about both of them because of something that Archbishop Tutu had once said. I did some work with him, and he said, you know, he said, unless we understand each other's stories, we will never understand each other. And I wanted to write a book about the apartheid years, but so many have written about so much, you included. And I thought the only way that I could really do this was to take one single case out of the tens of thousands of terrible cases of human rights violations and take it from the top all the way through, you know, mercilessly, all the way through to the very, very bitter end and say to people, this is what one case looked like. And then to amplify that and say, and there were tens of thousands more. And we do need to remember that and to try and do something about it. I don't know if we can. I'm just one person, but I did what only one person can do. I wrote a book and I hope it helps.
And we thank you for this. It's an excellent book. I think it's very important. I think it's critical. I think it in so many ways tells the story of so many people, not in its minutiae, but in so much of the, I think a lot of people will be able to identify with that experience. And for those who don't necessarily identify with it, I think it actually offers a perspective, which I think informs a lot of, as you had said earlier, why we are where we are today and aids us in that healing that we are still going through as a nation. Beverly, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for such a thoughtful interview. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.